Real solutions in Maine for ending homelessness. Homelessness often seems like one of those impossibly difficult problems in our society. Many Americans can't remember a time when there weren't homeless people on the streets, especially in America's towns and cities. It's estimated that on any given night, nearly 650,000 people in America are without a stable place to call home. But despite the frustrating numbers, there is real progress in tackling homelessness, innovative solutions that work. And some Maine organizations are among the national leaders in this effort. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn about some of the initiatives around Maine to reduce homelessness, including efforts to help homeless veterans, those considered chronically homeless, families, and children. What are your questions about helping the homeless in your community? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It's hard to see people in our communities living on the streets, in tents, or in the woods, but the fact is we do have a significant number of those without a home here in Maine. We also have a number of organizations who are working hard to find solutions to homelessness. We'll hear about the progress they're making around the state. Joining me in our studio today, Stephanie Prim. She's Executive Director of Hospitality House in Rockland, and Mark Swan. He's Executive Director of Preble Street in Portland. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you wish you knew what to do to help those who are homeless? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Mark, I'll start with you. You know, here in Portland, looking around, it seems that homelessness is on the rise. Is that really the case?
No, actually, the numbers have been pretty steady the last couple of years, maybe even a slight decrease. I think what you're seeing, or you might be seeing, is there are fewer shelters. So there's more people in just one or two areas. And related to that, there's a lot more people sleeping outside than we've ever seen before in Portland.
Why are there fewer shelters?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. Just in the last 10 years, I think six agencies have closed seven shelters in Portland, and that includes Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, The Y, Ingraham, Youth Alternatives, you know, very good, strong, well-established organizations. I think the primary reason, though, when you get right down to it, is funding. There's just really very, very little public support, meaning government funds, to run homeless shelters. The work is hard. It's politically challenging. It's tough with neighborhood politics. It's really hard on staff. You know, it's very sad and tragic work, and not easy. And so when you combine that with significant financial pressures, a lot of shelters have closed up.
Stephanie, Hospitality Houses in Rockland, what do you see on the Mid-Coast? What is is there an increase, decrease, the same kind of situation as in Portland with the homeless situation in Rockland, or is there a different sort of set of dynamics going on?
Well, we're in a little bit of a different scenario in that we are just 2.5 years old, so we are still trying to ascertain the demand in our more rural setting. We serve not only Knox, but a good part of Lincoln, about halfway down to Lincoln, and also all of Waldo. There are no other dedicated homeless organizations. So we've seen a spike in the last month, actually. Our caseload went from about 250 to 310 as of a couple of days ago. We were double-checking. So I'm hoping that that's not an indicator of a consistent uptick. But I will say that it has been over the last 2.5 years, after the first 6 months, the caseload has been sitting between 225 and 275.
I'll ask both of you this, Stephanie. The people who are coming to you, why are they coming to you? What has made them homeless?
Well, I can answer for Portland. You know, it's complex. I mean, I think people think about homelessness, either the problem of it, the tragedy of it, or the solutions for it, in pretty simple terms often. But it's far from simple. It's about poverty first and foremost. It's about housing costs, and in Portland we're seeing incredible, you know, housing costs right now as the city gets gentrified. It's very, very significantly about untreated mental illness and addictions. That's why it's, you know, it's hard to come up with solutions like we're going to talk about today. But, you know, for every person, we served about 320 people breakfast just this morning. And for each one of them, there's sort of a different story. But often it revolves around one of those issues.
Often there's a different story. I was doing some reading this morning in preparation for this program, and I learned something I hadn't seen before, that the National Low-Income Housing Coalition estimates that the housing wage is $18.79 per hour, that somebody needs to make about $19 an hour to be able to afford housing. Is that right for Maine? Is that what you all estimate?
I think that's very accurate in the Portland area.
Yeah, and for us, it's so interesting on intake in terms of our tracking of these cases. 32% of our audience or our client base attribute their homelessness directly to the cost of housing and the lack of affordable housing.
And as the Rockland area has also become gentrified, in some ways it's a wonderful thing. Some of these beautiful old homes in Rockland are being fixed up. The downtown is sparkling, but I bet you're seeing housing prices rise there as well.
Housing prices rise, and also just an absence of living wage jobs and general economic strength and business that isn't seasonal.
Well, let's talk about solutions. And Mark, I know that Preble Street is one of the leaders in the nation and something called the Housing First model. Explain to those of us who don't know, or to those of our listeners who don't know what Housing First, what that means, and how Preble Street has embraced that philosophy.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. You know, we get asked there are so many stories in the media about homelessness and people sleeping outside and untreated addictions and crowded shelters. So honestly, Jennifer, to be able to talk about solutions and the good work that can happen is a real pleasure. We opened our first Housing First project almost 12 years ago, Logan Place, and it's housing specifically designed and staffed and supported for people who are chronically homeless, people who have been literally stuck in shelters and on the streets for years and years, even decades.
And I remember at the time talking to you, and you were explaining how this is turning the old model on its head.
That's right. Yeah, that's it. Really, for decades, has been a housing readiness model where you say to a person, look, if you get sober, if you get a job, if you see a psychiatrist, and if you get a Medicaid number, you know, if you take that sort of linear route, at the end of that, we'll be able to help you find some housing. And that's not a terrible model, and it works for a lot of people. But particularly if people have untreated mental illness and trauma and have been on the streets for years and years, as much as we might wish all those things would happen, they just don't happen. They're just not happening for about 15 or 20% of the population. They're just stuck. So this model really kind of turns that on its head and said, you know what? We're going to provide you housing, just free and clear. You don't have to, you know, have a diagnosis. You don't need a Medicaid number. You don't need to get sober. You don't need a Medicaid number. You don't need a Medicaid number. I'm going to keep saying that because that drives so much of the social service world, and not everybody has Medicaid. So we turn that upside down and say, we'll provide you housing. And then what we discovered is once people are housed and stable and they're not worried about where they're sleeping that night or if they're safe that night, they actually do start to work on their sobriety, on their mental health, on their employability, on their family relations, on their physical health. And we see just lives turned around. I mean, the night we opened Logan Place in March of 2005, shelter numbers in Portland went down by 10%, and they stayed down for 4 years. That very night, I mean, it wasn't around the time. It was the very night we opened, the census numbers went down, and they stayed down till the recession hit. I mean, we saw a 10% drop in Portland homelessness because of one 30-unit apartment building, and that represents about a 5% drop for the whole state of Maine, given that about half the population is in Portland. It's an incredible success, and it was sustainable as well, and that's because we focused and targeted on the most challenging people who were just stuck in shelters, And we also – and I'll shut up now – but we also saw incredible cost savings as a result of this. And it was the cost savings that Governor Baldacci carried with him, as well as the, you know, the family reunions and the shelter numbers going down, but incredible cost savings that allowed us to get Florence House open.
And when you – Florence House is for women, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you say cost savings, do you mean these are people who are not going to the emergency room as often, that they're not being – police officers are not responding to calls that maybe they've passed out on a sidewalk, things
right.
like that?
Absolutely. We and I'm looking at it right now. We did a study with a national research firm independent of us. And we studied people's the cost for people the year before they moved into Logan Place and compared that with the year after. These are actual specific costs that we found for our tenants. Healthcare costs in the community decreased by 70% after they were housed. Ambulance usage decreased 71%. Jail time decreased 88%. Mental health care dropped 35%. We actually had more mental health services for people, but at a 35% decrease in cost because it was more managed care, preventative work. It wasn't acute emergency crisis kind of work, which is very expensive, and inpatient psychiatric stays and things like that. I mean, it gives me chills just reading this because it just shows the this makes economic sense as well as it does human sense.
Mm. Stephanie, I want to turn to you. Tell me about the work that Hospitality House does and how it's different than what some other homeless organizations are doing.
I just, if I could just chime in first and just sort of reinforce the Housing First model and say that I wish more of us in the rural parts of Maine had access to that, because for us, there really are no options for people with severe mental health or substance abuse issues, and we do everything we can for everyone who comes to us. But as you know, the resources simply don't exist for so many. And in terms of our program, so we are the Knox County Homeless Coalition, and Hospitality House is the most well-known part of that and is our shelter. It is a family shelter, but I think a lot of people who know about it drive by and think, oh, the homeless people in the area are being taken care of in that beautiful old Victorian home, and that's really simply not the case. We can only shelter about 10% of our caseload in that particular shelter. We use hotel rooms, which are far from ideal, but at least they can provide shelter in an unsafe situation. If someone is at risk of abuse or weather-related stuff, but that all costs a lot of money. Our program is grounded in the same values as Mark's, really meeting people where they are and no judgment, and approaching them with respect and dignity and genuine caring. Most of our clients the majority, I'd say 60%, are out of a generational poverty background, cycles of abuse, domestic violence, poverty, and very low education levels. We're at 34% of our audience got through the seventh grade. So trying to educate people about that and have people appreciate that if we meet people where they are and just get them to trust human beings again and give our staff enough time to get to know them and work with them to bring them to their best possible place. That is our mission. Our mission is to get our people, our clients, to sustainable independence, to help them help themselves, to help them eventually get to a point where they can increase their earning potential through education. Not easy by any stretch. People didn't reach this point in 5 minutes, right? If it's generations of people who have not had the opportunities that some of us had, it's going to take more than a week in a shelter or 2 weeks of case management to help them out of that.
You said you've been open 2.5 years. Do you have any stories to share about people who have been able to overcome that and are now living in a more
absolutely.
Stable situation?
Yes. We are very, very proud of that our families out in independence are currently, we have a less than 5% recidivism in that group. I attribute part of that to our aftercare support program, which
for children,
for everyone in independence, but most of our clients have children, are either single parents or are a nuclear family. So I attribute a lot of that success to aftercare, and I'll explain that in the context of this story. There's a young woman who was in our shelter fairly early on for 7 months with her two sons. One of her sons is what I would call a musical prodigy, and the other one is a lovely young man who does suffer from autism. And 7 months after being in the shelter, we were finally able to get her housed. I have a beautiful thank you note here from her. We can read it later if you want to, but it's basically thanking us for saving her life. She is now employed at a local Hannaford. About a year and a couple months after her being housed, she has a car that was donated by a donor. We've had it repaired, and that is allowing her to be independent, to keep a job. She volunteers at the soup kitchen, and she comes back and helps us in our garden.
Oh, wow. And Mark, why don't you tell us a story or two from Logan House and Florence House? Logan Place, what kind of things are you seeing happen there?
Oh, well, Logan Place is you know, just such a very special place. It's a real community there with the 30 people who've moved in. And, you know, I've been wanting to tell you this story for years. We did Maine Public Radio did a story on homelessness many years ago, and they interviewed a gentleman who had been on the streets for years and was then moving into Logan Place. And the next day, we got a call from a lawyer at one of the major law firms here in Portland, and she was quite emotional because she had heard her father's voice for the first time in about 10 years. She didn't know if he was alive or dead. She didn't know where he was, but she recognized his voice, and she was a very successful lawyer in Portland. So through a social worker, we reconnected father and daughter, and they spent really the next few years rebuilding and then sustaining a very healthy, loving relationship until, unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. But it's the family reunions that we've seen at Logan Place and in Florence House that are just so emotional for us and so meaningful to see a son, you know, in his 40s be able to go back home for Thanksgiving meal with his aging parents or his siblings that he hasn't seen in 20 years. Just that whole, you know, loving connection that we all need. And when you're on the streets and when you're struggling with hardcore addictions, it's pretty hard to sustain those relationships. So in that case, I had known that gentleman since my first day on the job. So to see him reconnect with his family is just really, really special.
In the 12 years that Logan Place has been open, you did mention that one man had passed away. How many of the original 30 inhabitants are still there, or what kind of turnover is there?
I think there's about 12 who are still there, and the number one reason that people have left is because they've died. That's by far the number one reason, sadly, that we have open apartments. I never would have known going into this work 25 years ago the extent to which we are immersed in grief and the grieving process. We lose an awful lot of our clients, our friends, our community every year. Just yesterday we learned about another tenant at Logan Place who'd passed away. It's a population that's gone through years of untreated physical illnesses as well as mental illnesses, and they've lived hard lives. And there's all kinds of studies that show people who've experienced homelessness for any period of time at all in their lives live about 20 years less than the average American.
Mm. Well, we do have to take a break. When we come back, some of your comments and questions. We're talking about solutions to homelessness. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Ever-Present of Portland. Securing family memories across generations, local services include photo scanning and converting home movies to DVD. EverPresent. maincalling.com.
Brazilian coffee growers are on the front lines of the effects of climate change.
I'm being led over a desiccated, dry coffee field. The leaves are curled up in rust-colored piles, and the plants themselves are completely denuded.
I'm Audie Cornish, Coffee and the Climate, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4. The PBS NewsHour on Maine Public Television stands apart. It's news the way you want and expect your television news to be. Each evening at 7, a full hour of coverage, the top stories and issues of the day, objectively explored and discussed in depth with differing viewpoints. It's news you can trust with prominent guests and intelligent voices. The most important issues of the day from around the globe, all helping to make sense of our complicated and ever-changing world. The PBS NewsHour at 7 weeknights on Maine Public Television and at 10 on the Maine Public Television World Channel.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, coming up with solutions to homelessness. With me in our studio, Mark Swan, Executive Director of Preble Street, and Stephanie Prim, Executive Director of Hospitality House. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Phil Allen. He's Director of Veterans Housing Services at Preble Street. Phil, why is there a program specifically dedicated to veterans? Are their needs different from others?
And thank you for having me. The answer to the question, I think, comes from the shared experience that veterans have. And there are some unique characteristics of veterans that we see that tend to make things a little bit more difficult as they readjust back from their service time that could kind of overlay into their homelessness. But generally, what we see, our experience is that they have equally complex issues to the general homeless population, as sort of Mark spoke to. They have a complex mental health issues. They have many housing and poverty-related issues or barriers that they need to address. We do see higher prevalence of things like post-traumatic stress disorder, as many people talk about and would assume. We also see a prevalence of traumatic brain injuries with some of the veterans. But most of the veterans that we work with are an older population, and they have really experienced a very similar life to an individual that finds themselves struggling with homelessness at any given time, eroded family networks, inaccessibility, or unable to secure financial resources that would really change their outcome or have some major impact on that.
I understand this is part of a national initiative that no veteran should be homeless and that Preble Street's working throughout the state of Maine, not only in the Portland area. Phil, what are some of the really small things that you have found make a difference? I understand Stephanie earlier was talking about getting one of her clients a car. That can be critical for someone you're helping, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's the access to the permanent solutions. Our program can assist. It is a nationwide program funded through the VA through the Support Services for Veteran Families grant, and there's approximately 360-plus grantees across the country. And we have a great deal of temporary financial assistance that we can offer to help with things like automobile repairs or first month's rent or security deposit. But from its inception, and one of the reasons why Preble Street, I feel, was almost destined to do this work as the grant was written, is that it's a service-centric grant, meaning that we do have a lot of resources available financially, but it really, the solution comes from case management, engaging a veteran beyond their immediate financial needs and involving them in a conversation that will help them find their own solutions and engage them in a way and engage them in a way that provides support ongoing.
Phil, I know the goal is no homeless veteran. Do you believe that's a realistic goal? Can we get there?
Well, I think that the VA has come out with this idea of a functional zero, and I think that it's probably more appropriate to look at it as a systemic end to veteran homelessness. And as Mark sort of spoke to, is that the complexities around homelessness are deep and vast and dynamic, and I think the solutions need to be equally vast and complex and dynamic. However, there's some very simple solutions, and you know, our founder Joe Chrysler often sort of had these truths that really helped to progress people down the path of stability. And one of them was to learn a person's name every day. And doing that is one of the key strategies to actually ending veteran homelessness. We have a functioning by name list of all the veterans that are presently homeless in the state of Maine. And there's a great deal of power that takes place with being able to have dynamic and complex conversations around those individual service needs and really allocating and directing services to a specific individual at a specific time. You know, it's founded in some very basic social work practice, but in play, when it's somewhat a complex relationship to figure out how we're going to have all the releases of information and the ability to share that information with each other. But once we do have that, it's a major cornerstone to the solutions that we're seeing in the veteran community.
Well, Phil Allen, thanks so much for joining us. That was Phil Allen with Preble Street's Veterans Housing Services, which is a statewide initiative. Mark, let me ask you, we will put information on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page with information for people who want to learn about this. But if they don't have access to a computer or to internet, can someone call 411 and be directed to the right place?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, great. We're going to go to Mark, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just calling because I used to be a community case manager for New Beginnings Youth Shelter in Lewiston. And I just kind of wanted to say that the staff who work at that place are just absolutely phenomenal. It's kind of a sad state of affairs that, you know, we have some youth workers who put in 40 plus hours a week at locations such as that. Honestly, you know, there's just not enough money or funding to go around to really help out a lot of the homeless youth in the state of Maine. I mean, perfect example, I still speak with a lot of those staff members, and I just heard recently that they had a teenage client there, a female, who was expecting a baby, and the staff chipped in to provide her with a baby shower. I mean, that's just amazing to me that the staff who put in those long hours and work really hard, you know, they're taking money out of their own pockets to really support these kiddos. And I guess what I wanted to say is that when I was working there, we actually had a conversation about changing the name from New Beginnings Youth Shelter to something that really spoke more volumes about what they actually provide, because it's really more than a shelter. You know, it's not just a place for kids to go because they're having a rough time of it. I mean, they offer education and all these other things. And I guess I'm curious to know, what are your thoughts about the homeless youth situation in the state of Maine, about changing the name for a location such as New Beginnings so it's not so intimidating? You know, when I was working there, I remember that the number of children that we had seen since the opening, which I believe was in the early 80s, was about 8,500 youth between the ages of 13 and 18. That's a huge number. And I'm just curious to know, is Maine making progress in having less homeless youth, or are we kind of just staying the same?
All right. Good question, Mark.
Oh, I have so many thoughts. First of all, thank you for the good work you did. I'm sure you did at New Beginnings, which is a terrific organization. And I'm going to talk a little bit. I will answer your question, but I was so struck and so pleased. I'm sitting here smiling when Phil Allen, who works at Preble Street, basically quoted Joe Chrysler, the founder of Preble Street. And I'm quite certain Phil didn't start working at Preble Street till probably 5 years after Joe had died. So how wonderful is that, you know, Phil has kept the legacy of this wonderful person, Joe Chrysler, who founded Preble Street. And that just got me thinking about solutions. And, you know, one solution is people doing this kind of work and really putting their all into it, like the caller Mark, or like Phil and his team, or like I've gotten to know almost all of the staff at Stephanie's shelter. And there's just extraordinary people. It's those people who are the solutions,
lots
ultimately.
Lots of baby showers on all sides,
absolutely.
Mark.
And, you know, Phil and his team put on a wedding for two veterans in Bangor and helped buy the dress and actually put on the wedding for people. So thank you.
We had two weddings in the last 6 months on the property.
It's just great to, you know, the people who do the work are extraordinary. And just to speak to your question, I agree shelter can be the wrong word and very limiting, particularly given the scope of what New Beginnings does and what Hospitality House does and what Preble Street does. It's far more than a shelter. I think the homeless youth issue, and I think we're really talking about unaccompanied youth, teenagers. And I'll just tell you one of the things we've just started in the last couple of years, we've been running a shelter for teenagers ages 12 to 21 for years. And just about 3 years ago, we started a new program, a transitional program to help kids get out of the shelter who were really stuck there. Again, some of the hardest to serve with many challenges. We were funded by the John T. Gorman Foundation to run this program. We call it First Place, which I love that name. And it really is a two-year program where we get into a lease situation with a landlord. Preble Street signs the lease. We're the leaseholder. And we help a young person move into that apartment. And the goal being within 2 years, or certainly by the end of 2 years, that young person will be the leaseholder and will be 100% responsible for that. And then what we do in those 2 years, we wrap around a lot of services and really focus on that young person to help find, to help get high school diplomas, GEDs, get jobs. We have a young person who showed up at our place in the middle of the night, teenager all by himself, a refugee from Africa who had to flee his country because of torture and persecution. His mother was in jail for political purposes and all alone in this country. And he, after being in our shelter for several months, he was able to enroll in the First Place program. And within those 2 years, he finished high school. He got a scholarship to a local community college. He got a full-time job with health insurance. He's saving money right now for a car. A lot of PTSD has come out in conversation and what he went through in his home country. He's now getting mental health services. He's in a support group. And I have many stories like that just from that First Place program. And I know New Beginnings does very similar work in the Lewiston area. And so what that means is, you know, this young person, instead of being on the street and curled up in a ball in our teen center crying every day, is now in school, he's working, he's paying taxes, he's got an apartment, he's built his credit up, he's built a tenant history. I mean, this young man is on his way. There's no question about it. 3 years ago, he had none of that.
Stephanie, Mark mentioned the First Place program is 2 years, and that's about the timeline that you find it takes for family members to achieve the kind of stability we would all want.
That's what we're feeling at this point. Some are obviously less. I wish more were, you know, 2 weeks away from
stability. When we're thinking realistically about helping the people you help, we need to think year and a half, 2 years.
Absolutely, without question. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for calling. I'm going to move to Jeff because he has a question I want to ask anyway. So, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. It's sort of a two-pronged question. Actually, it sort of developed a little bit further from this last response you had about First Place. I personally am not involved in the issue that we're discussing as a professional, but my first question is I'm wondering how it is that we, or actually myself, could be of help, whether it's volunteer time somewheres. Obviously, I would love to be able to sit down and write a large check. That's not something I can do.
Okay, Jeff, let me give that question to Stephanie because that was on my notes. It's scribbled in front of me. How can one help? I know obviously money always helps, but if someone's not in a position to write you a big check, are there other ways in which they can help you, Stephanie?
Absolutely. Volunteers are such a huge part of our program. And I know they're a significant part of probably all of ours in the state of Maine who do this work. For us, mentors, for example, are very, very important. We try to train And then introduce mentors to our families who are out in independence so that as they are progressing toward confidence building, job skills, further education, and better earning potential, as they meet the roadblocks that we all do in life, there is a bond forming with a mentor who becomes yet another friend in addition to our staff. A support in the community, someone to give them rides, someone to help them troubleshoot or get ready for an interview. Those can be even more intimidating for some of our clients who have experienced trauma. So just one example. Also, people who want to learn about us and so believe in us that they are willing to go and really speak about it to other people. Education about this is, in my very, very limited experience so far, one of the biggest needs. People misunderstand this to a degree that's a little frightening, especially in the rural parts of Maine. I think homelessness is invisible. We have a wonderful client. His name is Jim. He was working more than full time and camped out behind a McDonald's up in the Midcoast. And we put him in a hotel room and pretty much saved his life before a big snowstorm so that he could get a job and he could work and he wanted to. And he said to us not too long ago, we're very good at hiding. Our clients live in the woods. They live in storage units, in sheds. And a lot of people come to me and say, there's not a homeless problem here, here in vacation land. So I think if there are people who want to help us with communication, of course, there's always a need to just go and have fun and reintroduce a family to something that reignites that pilot light of hope that has probably been long since extinguished. Reading to kids, playing with taking a family to the beach. Simple, simple things can make a huge difference.
All right. Thanks so much for your question, Jeff. We do have to go to another break. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties, Casella, giving resources new life, and Dixfield Foam Insulation, committed to conserving energy in new and existing buildings through spray insulation, dixfieldfoaminsulation.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the author of Marijuana, A Short History, John Hudak. 24 states have legalized medical marijuana, 4 permit recreational use, but pot remains illegal under federal law. We'll talk about some of the challenges ahead as pot becomes an increasingly big business in an age of conflicting laws and regulations. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for ideas from the CBC. Today, replacing the professionals. Technology is not just taking over factory jobs, according to British author and scholar Richard Susskind. It's about to do the jobs of professionals as well. What does this mean for the future of professional work by humans? We'll hear more today on Ideas after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Finding Solutions to Homelessness in Maine. Joining me in the studio today, Stephanie Prim, who's Executive Director of Hospitality House, and Mark Swan, Executive Director of Preble Street. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. What you all have been describing so far, the things that work, whether it's the wrapping services around a client, providing housing, I can't imagine that those things are not cheap. Where does the funding come from? Is there enough funding? Has there been a change in the kinds of funding recently?
Well, funding is an enormous challenge that I think keeps Stephanie up at night, keeps me up at night, and maybe the hardest part of our jobs is sustaining the work that we do. There's very little government funding for the actual shelter work. You know, we're talking a lot about solutions, and like our veterans program that Phil talked about, that's funded by the Veterans Administration, and it's a federal program, and that's great. But actually running, operating homeless shelters, emergency shelters, overnight shelters, drop-in centers, soup kitchens, things like that, there really is not much in the way of government support. There's some, for sure, but not much. So we are constantly looking for private funds from foundations and the faith community and individuals. It's a full-time job just to keep that going so you can keep your doors open.
And Stephanie, I know you want to open two more houses, right? Did I read that on your website, that that's your goal?
We are looking to expand our capacity over the next 5 years to replace our hotel rooms with alternatives that can be supportive, where there is staff available. That's aspirational, but first, obviously, we have to always pay attention to covering our operating costs. We are facing a significant cut in the reimbursement that we get through the Department of Health and Human Services for reimbursement of homeless case management, for example. Homeless case management.
Is this the State Department or the federal State Department? You're seeing a cut in the reimbursement
There's legislation pending for next year that would cut that up to, I believe, 38%. And just to give you a sense for what that means to us, the reason we're able to help as many people as we are outside of our shelter with wraparound case management is because of that. We only get reimbursement for clients who have Medicaid or main care. 45% of our clients do not have that. We still serve everyone. We are able to help everyone who comes to us in some way. That would be a significant blow to our program.
We're going to go to the calls. And Chris, who's the executive director of New Beginnings in Lewiston, is calling in. Thanks so much for calling in, Chris.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to talk a little bit more about youth homelessness and solutions to that. I know that there are lots of interventions that both New Beginnings, Shaw House, and Preble Street do once youth become homelessness. But the real challenge is preventing youth from entering into a state of homelessness through early identification and figuring out how to keep youth in their communities of origin so that they can have natural supports, stay in school, participate in any extracurricular activities they are, and stay connected with their faith communities. And that's one thing that we haven't been particularly good at in the state of Maine. And so thinking about how we can better organize ourselves as communities to support those youth and identify them early is really critical to preventing kids from coming to the urban centers and needing shelter services and drop-in services and transitional living programs. And one of the ways to do that is through host home services, which is an intervention where a youth would go to a house in a community and get support from a different family while a crisis situation is being resolved in the home. And figuring out how to fund that, how to identify the kids and the families is the challenge that we're currently facing in the state so that kids can get better services and not enter into our homelessness.
Is what you mean kind of formalizing what happens all over Maine anyway for kids who have, you know, for some reason their families are in crisis and they go and stay with a friend?
Yep.
Identifying those kids who don't naturally have another family to reach out to and finding a family for them?
Yeah, even the ones who are currently called couch surfing, identifying who they are and providing supports to them while they're in those homes, providing supports to the family that they're coming from, and also providing support to the family that's hosting them, so that they can really either get back to their family of origin so that whatever drew them out has been resolved, or they can continue to stay with that host family, and that family has the resources to take on the responsibility of partially parenting that kid and keeping them connected in their community.
Is there an organized effort, if someone is listening to this program right now and says, we could do that, we could be a host family, where do I sign up? What do you say to them?
Well, currently in the state, there are a couple of faith organizations that are doing that. And there was a new law passed in May of 2016. It's called LD 1065, which opens the door for others to begin doing that. And I think we're just in the beginning phases of talking about how to operationalize host homes statewide and really make an effort to intervene in the lives of these kids before they become homeless and prevent them from becoming homeless.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for calling in. Chris is Executive Director of New Beginnings in Lewiston. Thank you. We'll move on then. We'll move on to Joanne, who's calling from Waldoro. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Well, thank you for this excellent program and for your really great panel. And they have several of your panelists keep making the point about the importance of knowing people who are homeless as individuals and getting their individual story. And I worked with homeless people in Fairbanks, Alaska, and then with a lay health worker program in rural Kentucky, which worked with people who are uninsured and impoverished. And I think I just wanted to say that over a lifetime, you meet a lot of people, and you forget a lot of people. But when you get to know the individual homeless people, they are amongst those you never forget. Just because you knew their stories, you knew what happened to them, they become part of your a compendium of memory of people that you've known. So that point about knowing people as individuals and working with them from their own perspective and their own stories is just really important, I think, and key to making sure these programs work well. So thank you again, and thanks to all your panelists.
Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you. I think sounds like she's part of the solution as well. And those of us who work at Preble Street, and I'm sure Stephanie feels the same way, we feel really honored to be doing this work. I mean, people let us into their lives and are very much lacking pretensions and are being quite honest and sometimes brutally honest with us when they talk about their lives and what they're going through. And it really is a special relationship. And again, I think it's an honor to be part of this work.
Some of the most generous and appreciative people that I have ever met in my life.
We'll move to Clay, who's from Presque Isle. Hi, Clay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm coming from the homeless side. Originally from Sanford. I'm going to really kind of condense all this. I spent the last 10 years in Sanford in a storage unit that nobody knows about. I had tried many attempts to get housing through the Sanford Housing Authority. I qualified. I had just came from a housing authority in Tennessee. I qualify. Some of the problems that, I have surgery, hip surgery coming up in December, okay? I spent last winter in Lincoln area, Maine, in my truck with my dog, and I was working part-time plowing the rest areas up in Midway, Maine, which is, near Lincoln. And all the time, I get Social Security disability. I gravitated up towards Lincoln because the Housing Authority would have nothing to do with me because I didn't have a physical residence and I couldn't go to a shelter because I had a service animal. So nobody would take. So, some pretty cold nights when you're talking about 20, 30 below in my truck. And before I'd left Stanford, they mentioned that, I told them, I said, I could go to Bangor and get housing. And my caseworker said, and she laughed, go to Bangor. Well, and I ended up doing that. I was eating and showering at the Hope House in Bangor. Awesome facility. And I'll wrap this up with this last part. Still, I want you to know that I get surgery coming up in December. Have no way to get there. I'm in Presque Isle. No way to get to and from. And the other thing is, too, that Sanford doesn't have any place for the homeless people to eat. They got to go to Alfred at the Brothers over there to be able to eat. And they don't really – it's not really set up for the public. So not only do we need an executive director of the Sanford Housing Authority that can understand and wrap their head around – and work with this homeless community, which is huge in Sanford, We also need the police department to not be so aggressive and summons people and kick them out of the Walmart parking lot, stuff like that. It's a big problem. I sent you guys some information. I emailed it to you.
Well, Clay, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're getting so close to the end of the hour. I want to give our guests a chance to respond.
Well, it's a terrible story. I'm so sorry you're still stuck. I there's parts of the story I don't, you know, maybe we can talk offline, but if you have a service animal, you absolutely should be able to go to a shelter. Again, we can talk about that. But I do think, you know, the story you're sharing, and I'm sure there's more to it, just speaks to how complex this stuff is. I mean, this is a person who's about to have significant medical surgery and has no place to recuperate, no place to stay, and is, you know, really struggled in a rural state without a heck of a lot of services.
Clay, and I've jotted down your number, and I'll pass that on to Mark after the program. We'll move on to one more call. Michael, we're awfully close to the end of the program, but wanted to give you a chance to ask your question. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Michael Anthony. I'm with a peer support and advocacy group called Homeless Solidarity Project, and we actually got started in Portland a couple of years ago. We used to run peer support groups in the kitchen at Preble Street. I don't know if Mark remembers that, but I'm happy about just having this conversation and everyone speaking. So I'm really, we're on to a lot of really great solutions. And I just want to bring up the peer support stuff. I want to thank Clay for sharing his story. It's important that peers are allowed to participate in these conversations. All too often our peers are shut out. You know, we hear from a lot of professionals and politicians on both sides of the aisle, and not a lot of peers get to participate.
Sure. I agree, Michael, and I appreciate your call. Mark, just the few little tiny bit of time we have left, I want to ask you, we started the program talking about the Housing First model, and you're hoping to expand that. You have something under construction.
Yeah, our work in Housing First is in partnership with Avesta Housing and with the Portland Housing Authority, and our third facility is coming online next spring, which we're extremely excited about, but we're also quite frustrated and concerned because we don't have the funding that we need to fully realize what we want to do there. So, I mean, that's honestly, it's the nature of the beast, I think. For us, we're a very mission-driven organization, and we keep kind of pushing forward with new efforts, new experiments, new solutions all the time. It's very, very rare where there's actually a funding source that, you know, supports that or allows that or encourages even that kind of entrepreneurship. So we're excited, but we're nervous.
All right. Well, that's going to have to be the last thing is said this hour. Mark Swan, Executive Director of Preble Street. Stephanie Prim, Executive Director of Hospitality House. Thank you both for being here. John Keimel ran the board. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thursday on the program, we're talking about the future of recycling in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.